supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Wednesday's student walkout pressing for tighter gun control laws and better safety in schools was just the latest bit of advocacy for one Delaware senior. And this time, she ended up making a presentation to state lawmakers and getting an audience with the governor. WHYY's Chris Barish reports.
The Valentine's Day shooting that killed 17 at a Florida high school once again spurred Dunya Ramadan to action. The Newark Charter School student has long been an advocate for women's issues. She also runs a Huddle for Justice group that pushes social and environmental issues. So after a gunman took so many lives in Parkland, Ramadan wasted no time helping organize a group chat that ultimately led about 24 high schools to join the protests.
I laid out a foundation document regarding how the walkouts are supposed to go uniformly throughout the state in order to create a uniform message and an effective one.
Ramadan emceed Newark Charter School's walkout, calling for action.
Tragedy keeps on going, and we have not taken action. It's been too long. And today, you are all standing here in solidarity with students all across the nation, standing against gun violence, demanding for change.
Her efforts also brought invitations from lawmakers, and Ramadan was one of a few students who testified Wednesday on behalf of raising the age limit to buy a rifle to 21. Afterwards, she was one of about a dozen students to sit down with Governor John Carney, who has called for a ban on assault-style rifles.
He was extremely receptive, as in he was listening to all of our ideas, and we had really serious discussions regarding what steps to take.
Ramadan is undecided about where to attend college, but is waiting to hear from Yale and Georgetown, among others. She aspires to be an international human rights lawyer, or perhaps wade into politics. From the Delaware Desk, Chris Barish, WHYY News.
The March for Our Lives rally in Washington, D.C., scheduled for 1 week from tomorrow, will again focus attention on gun violence. Let's assess public attitudes with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, with all the attention on guns and mass shootings, where does the public stand in general on a desire to see stricter gun laws?
Well, it is as high as we've seen it now for a couple of decades, and I think that's very important. The question we ask, Dave, is do you think that gun laws should be made stricter, less strict, or kept about like they are? We're now at 67% who say that gun laws should be stricter. And as I mentioned, we have to go all the way back into the early 1990s to find a percentage of Americans saying it was that high. It's been as low as 44%. Within the last decade, who said laws should be stricter. This is a jump of 7 points since when we asked it last. And, of course, we did these questions after the Parkland shootings in Florida, so probably the uptick is a direct result of that tragedy. Now we're at the highest point, as I mentioned, in many years.
Does Gallup dive in a little deeper in terms of what aspects of gun regulations would be prioritized?
We do. We did a special poll to try to get at Americans' feelings about what should be done to make laws stricter. And here's how I divide the world up. We tested 7 broad categories of things that could be done. And 4 of them, I think, are non-controversial. Republicans, Democrats, you name it, everybody agrees with things like increasing training for police officers to respond to shootings, background checks, which is 90% plus of Americans support universal background checks, more security checkpoints at schools, trying to spend more money to identify students who may become threats, all of those things, some of which were included in the House bill that was voted on this past week, are no-brainers to Americans. They say yes to those. Things that are controversial, 2 of them, raising the age limit to 21, not as high, but still a majority of Americans support that, and the idea of banning AR-15s or semi-automatic weapons, that's more controversial, but still slightly above the majority level. And the one thing that we tested, which does not reach majority support, is the idea of arming teachers.
Specifically, when you poll teachers, are they pretty much in lockstep about how they feel on that matter?
Well, we did a special poll of about 500 teachers, a representative national sample of teachers, and we asked them about this idea. After all, they'd be the ones who have to carry it out. And no, we have about 20% of teachers nationwide who say they support the idea, at least somewhat in favor of the idea of arming teachers. But we have 63% of teachers who are strongly opposed. We also have, about 25% or a little more who say they think it might be at least somewhat effective. These are teachers again. But I should point out, based on a number of other things that we tested that could be done to try to prevent school shootings, the idea of arming teachers is the very bottom of the list, according to teachers themselves.
Do teachers, in turn, have their own priorities for making schools more safe?
They do, and they mirror the general public to a significant degree. Background checks, banning the sale of automatic weapons are at the top of the list, so they're a little more likely to say that would be effective. Other kinds of gun control issues like banning bump stocks, teachers agree with. What's at the bottom of the list, other than arming teachers, according to teachers themselves, what they don't think would be that effective would be new federal programs to develop emergency response plans, increasing school security personnel. It would seem like that would be something that they might favor, but they don't think it would be that effective. And more security checkpoints, they don't think would be that effective either. So teachers tend to come down on things relating to making guns available more than anything else when it comes to preventing mass shootings at schools.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. Republicans in the Philadelphia region are concerned that President Donald Trump's proposal to hike tariffs on steel and aluminum may spark a trade war. But he's also getting some support from Democrats. WHYY's Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo reports.
Philadelphia area Republican Congressman Ryan Costello was caught off guard by Trump's plan to raise tariffs on steel and aluminum. But he says presidents do that sort of thing.
Well, look, I mean, I could complain about how President Obama orchestrated the Iran deal. I mean, every president, every administration is going to go about, you know, navigating their policy initiatives differently.
Costello, who represents parts of four counties west of Philadelphia, speaks for many in his party on the issue when he says he wants free trade. At the same time, he also doesn't want countries like China dumping cheap steel on the international market. As Trump tries to renegotiate trade deals, Costello says the president's opening offer may give him more leverage.
It's a big, unpredictable gray area, and I don't think that that's the smart way to go about renegotiating. But what did North Korea say today, right?
Costello says Trump's more isolationist view of America is not winning over Republicans in Congress.
Well, Trumpism is not entirely Republicanism, and I think probably the main area where there's differentiation is on the issue of trade.
Pennsylvania Democratic Senator Bob Casey has been a constant critic of the president. He even called on Trump to resign. But he likes that Trump is being aggressive on international trade.
We have had tremendous job loss in Pennsylvania when China cheats on trade, when they cheat on trade-related matters. They cheat on currency. They cheat on intellectual property. I mean, so when they cheat and other countries cheat on trade and especially on steel and aluminum, we pay the price. We lose jobs.
It's not just Casey. Philadelphia Democratic Congressman Brendan Boyle says Trump didn't start this trade war.
The fact is we're already involved in a trade war as it relates to steel. There has been massive Chinese dumping of steel.
Boyle says 10 years ago, the steel plant ArcelorMittal in Conshohocken was at 100% capacity, but they're now down to just 20% capacity. He says numerous administrations haven't been able to stop it. While he's still waiting for further details on Trump's tariff proposal, he says he's glad the president is taking action.
We'll bring actions against China in the World Trade Organization. We'll win those actions, and then China will simply get around it by exporting their steel to a third country like Vietnam. There'll be one little change in the steel, and then they will send it to the United States. So steel dumping is a real problem. I believe we do need action.
But over in New Jersey, the proposal is being decried on both sides of the aisle. The hasty rollout freaked out U.S. allies in Europe, who have threatened retaliatory measures. North Jersey Democratic Congressman Bill Pascrell says Trump should be focusing on China.
But for all of his talk on China, he's done nothing. Zero. Currency, zero. So he's playing patty cakes with us.
Republican Congressman Leonard Lance from Central Jersey says a tariff war could hurt everything from the shipping industry to farmers.
I'm opposed to tariffs. I'm a free trader. It's very important to New Jersey. New Jersey's position in the world is based upon world commerce, and I am a Republican free trader.
Some Republicans are exploring ways to rescind the president's trade authority, but the consensus seems to be that that would set a dangerous precedent for negotiating future trade deals. Lance says he's open to blocking the president's action.
I would be willing to look at any avenue because I think the will of Congress is that we should be a free trading nation.
So far, Republican leaders have opposed calls to vote on any tariff or trade bills, so it's unclear if these efforts will ever be brought up for a vote. For WHYY News, Matt Laszlo in Washington.
A city council proposal to extend Philadelphia's bar closing times to 4 a.m. is getting pushback from some unusual sources, as Jake Blumgart of WHYY's Plan Philly explains.
Councilwoman Blondell Reynolds Brown thinks bars should stay open until 4 a.m., but only as a means to help school children, of course. The idea that revenue raised via the liquor by the drink tax would bring in more money for public education.
Let's examine it and see if we can get to a different place, which then allows us to take fewer dollars or pull fewer dollars from our city's real estate taxpayers.
But similar proposals in the past have run into a buzzsaw of opposition. This time appears no different. And opponents aren't just neighborhood groups worried about noise or moralists critical about booze in general. Avram Hornick is the owner of some of the city's most popular bars and nightclubs, including the Dolphin and Morgan's Pier. He is not a fan of the proposal.
It's the worst idea I ever heard. All that's going to do is cause more problems, like people need to go home.
Hornick says people only really go out for 3 hours at a stretch, and therefore, shifting the closing time won't actually raise much more money. Instead, it will only change when most people hit the clubs, while allowing problem drinkers to keep going a few rounds longer. Councilman Mark Squilla, whose district covers many of the hippest parts of town, is also skeptical.
I'm not sure. I don't know if it's actually an idea that would make more money, because what I bartended for a long time, and the later you're out, sometimes when more trouble happens. So I have to hear some more details about it to be convinced.
The bill would also require enabling legislation from Harrisburg. Similar attempts to allow more local control over closing time have failed recently in Pennsylvania and California. Jake Blumgart, WHYY News.
All this week, WHYY has been examining gentrification in our series entitled Gentrified: Stories of Rapidly Changing Philadelphia. Our reporters heard from many city residents whose lives have been affected by the change, good and bad. And we've been asking for your thoughts and feedback as well. Joining us now to wrap up the series and discuss some of your responses is Annette John Hall, who wrote a few of the pieces this week. Welcome, Annette.
Thanks, Dave.
Annette, we'll get to listener and reader feedback, but first take a moment to review the scope of the series.
So our first story looked at some of the root causes of gentrification in Philly and went back to tell the story of how the Society Hill neighborhood has changed. And another piece looked at the fact that the data says whiter neighborhoods are actually gentrifying faster than traditionally black neighborhoods.
In addition, there was a focus on Strawberry Mansion, where committed neighbors are trying to keep what's theirs ahead of a wave of new development.
Yep, and another one looked at what the African-American middle class is doing in East Germantown. And the final piece at WHYY.org examines how an immigrant community is helping to make the neighborhood of Olney thrive.
So now let's take up some themes that emerge from audience feedback. And for one, just living through the physical signs of change.
Yeah. On Twitter, Harold Burnett, who didn't really tell us where he was living, but he had a really good description. He said, gentrification to him means waking up every morning to multiple construction projects, having multiple coffee shop options, dog parks, mixed-use buildings, multiple Air and Express weekends.
Race and gentrification was a second major theme.
Yeah, we got some pushback from a reader who said, just another in a never-ending series of articles that politely demonize people who dare to move into a low-income community and dare to have an opinion on their surroundings. That was from somebody whose tag was Rufus Deck. He was on Twitter. And we also heard from a 31-year-old white woman living in Ardmore. She's looking to buy a house in South Philly and is very anxious about her role as a possible gentrifier.
So we're kind of puzzled as to how do we become part of the community without hurting that community, without contributing to rising property taxes and things like that. How do we join a community like that as white allies as opposed to predators or something that's going to be seen as having a negative effect?
Annette, we also heard from someone who grew up in a white Irish Catholic neighborhood in Northeast Philadelphia and has seen it become much more diverse since she moved away.
I do know that the neighborhood has changed, and now it's not all white anymore, which is fine. I mean, people work hard. That's what matters. But I just felt like you only told the part of the story that was about people who are of color, and then they have white people coming in.
You know, she has a really valid point. We did try to get past stereotypes in this series. That's why we looked at East Germantown and Olney. And in East Germantown, we told the story of Mark Lamont Hill. He's a Temple professor who bought a row house in East Germantown about 15 years ago. And then he opened a coffee shop, which sort of flips the whole stereotype of gentrification on its head. Because the stereotype is that whites buy coffee shops and put in bike lanes. And Mark Lamont Hill is African-American and is doing this with black books and serving sweet potato pie and opening up this space for everybody, but really for established African-American residents in the neighborhood.
And we also heard from listeners who emphasized that there are both winners and losers as a result of rapid change.
Yeah, we heard from Peter Corahanis, who lives in Point Breeze in South Philly. He's white. He's been there for about a decade. And he says that the changes are good for homeowners of all colors.
Gentrification for me was not a bad thing. And I've always explained that to people that even for black people in my neighborhood here, it's not necessarily a bad thing. My next door neighbor, for example, who was very welcoming when I first moved in, you know, he told me he was 78, he had heart problems. So between my pension, my savings, and whatever this house is worth, it's probably going to pay for my nursing home.
Annette, looking back on the scope of the series, what else comes to mind?
Well, you know, Dave, it's more than just data. This is a real emotional topic. And what we found is that longtime residents don't know how to think about so-called interlopers taking over their neighborhood. And the newcomers don't want to be labeled as gentrifiers. Our research tells us that as these neighborhoods continue to change, the biggest fear is that low-income residents, renters and homeowners, black and white, can increasingly get priced out of neighborhoods. So it's sort of like a ghettoization of low-income people if this continues to happen.
Thanks, Annette.
Thank you.
Annette John Hall on Newsworks Tonight. You can listen to the entirety of Gentrified, Stories of Rapidly Changing Philadelphia at whyy.org. An accessory by a Philadelphia fashion designer has a cameo appearance in the world's biggest blockbuster right now. Black Panther features work by Wole Oyejide. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that the movie and the designer share a message of African pride.
Black Panther is a superhero action film with all the impossibly high-flying stunts you would expect from a Marvel comic book movie. Features a mythical African world emerging from self-imposed isolation with something to teach the world about power, leadership, and style.
Watching Black Panther for me as a person of color, as a Nigerian, was seeing my culture, or at least close adaptations of my culture, represented on the screen in a way that is not only authentic but pays a really loving homage to the idea that excellence can come from the African continent.
That is Wole Oyejide, an attorney turned fashion designer who started a company in West Philadelphia 5 years ago making men's suits out of boldly patterned fabric closely associated with dapper African style. He was asked to submit a handful of outfits for the review of Black Panther's costume designers. In the end, they used a scarf of his in a pivotal scene.
It's a little surreal to sit in a theater and, like, see your work the size of a wall and to have nobody in the room realize that you're the guy who made that.
The Black Panther phenomenon goes beyond action thrills, presenting the African continent in a highly commercial and fantastically popular global movie. Although much more humble, Oyejide's company, called Ekire Jones, does the same thing, showing African style as very modern and chic.
I grew up in a world where it was not really great or cool to be from the African continent. And so now we're arriving at a place where sophistication, elegance can come from Paris just as easily as it can come from Lagos or Nairobi or Kenya.
Black Panther, the movie, presents African culture as a gift to the rest of the world. Oyejide's clothes, likewise, are born in a very specific cultural tradition, but made to make anyone look like a movie star. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. Assistant news director, Katie Colinari. John Musoni is assistant vice president for news operations. At the controls this week, Al Banks, Charlie Kyer, and Adam Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is vice president of news and civic dialogue. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.